Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 10th day of August, Anno Domini 2024, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Sound Bites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And it's 6 minutes after the hour. We're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Have you paid your dues? Here comes the news.
And I suppose I need a headset.
Probably at some point you will.
If you want to hear it.
Google Chrome is among the first few things many of us install on a new computer. And although a few features of a desktop version haven't been ported to the app, it is among the best browsers on Android, too. However, a massive change has been breathing down extension developers' necks now. A shift to the Manifest V3 framework, which would make Manifest V2 and all the extensions built around it redundant and incompatible. Google has set the ball rolling, and it might spell the end of many ad-blocking extensions such as uBlock Origin. Last year, Google announced plans to deprecate Manifest V2 extensions in favor of V3, designed to give users a more polished experience. Since June 3rd, Google has started rolling out a warning accompanying all Manifest V2 extensions, saying they will soon stop working on stable dev and canary versions of the browser. The warning is now rolling out on Chrome 127, and ad blockers reliant on V2 are victims as well. Explaining the cause for this warning now showing up for all uBlock Origin users, the project's lead developer and maintainer, Raymond Hill, said uBlock Origin is reliant on V2 definitions. That's why Chrome is showing a warning now and suggesting users install another extension built with the new Manifest V3 framework. While uBlock Origin isn't the only one affected, it is the most widely recognized.
Mm-hmm.
If you're afraid to let go of uBlock, Hill says you might forego some capabilities, but Google's web store already suggests switching to uBlock Origin Lite, Ghostery, or AdBlock Plus. uBlock Origin Lite has been built with a Manifest V3 compliant approach, but it may not help with per URL filtering and other features, despite the developer's best efforts to ensure features are retained from the original version. While ignoring Google's warning isn't the best idea, you can defer the switch to Manifest V3 extensions. Google has the option to re-enable older V2 versions temporarily, but that option will go away soon as well. By the beginning of next year, Manifest V3 extensions will be the only ones in use. Given the scale at which businesses may be affected by this change, Google is giving enterprise users time until June 2025 when the Manifest V2 deprecation will begin for users. As for ad blockers, they were created out of necessity, and the light version may recover some features of the full version in the coming months as Manifest V3 becomes the new standard. You also have the option of switching to a different browser, at least on your desktop, because Firefox, for instance, doesn't plan to follow Google's footsteps to deprecate V2 extensions anytime soon. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is time to Google Chrome will soon block ad browsers. And your choices are time to switch to Firefox. Well, that's annoying. I'll wait and see. And I love ads. So far, we've got 30 votes. 24 of them are time to switch to Firefox. Zero of them are I love ads, and only one is I'll wait and see. And, of course, you can give us a call if you want to talk about this or dang near anything else, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415.
The one thing I've been doing is I installed it a while ago. It was DuckDuckGo. So if I'm going to go search for something, and I did an experiment. For the heck of it, I wanted to look at new office chairs. Figured, I'll pick that. And sure enough, the minute I was done with Chrome, all of a sudden now through Facebook and everything else, I'm seeing all these ads for that. But then when I was going over to DuckDuckGo and doing a search on stuff, doesn't bring back all the stuff that I was looking at before. It's like, I think from now on, if I'm going to do any searching and don't want to be inundated, because right now in Chrome, I'm constantly getting hit with, oh, well, you can get this chair here, and you can get this chair there. It's like, yeah, no, I don't want that anymore. So
both Brave and DuckDuckGo say they block ads. In fact, Brave will tell you how many it's blocked.
Oh, yep. Cool. I haven't tried that one.
The other big announcement from Google is they've been, for the last 4 years, they've been working on a way to stop cookies and just block all cookies, period. So right now, most web browsers will block third-party cookies, but not first-party cookies. And so websites are able to track you by those cookies. The irony is that Google is the biggest advertiser, so they're doing the most of the tracking. But for the last 4 years, they've been working on a replacement. The first one was called Flock, a federated learning of cohorts.
Yeah.
and the latest one was Topics, where the ads are picked on your computer, not by the giant ad service at the other end. And so they were going to, they had already announced they're going to turn off all cookies in a future version of Chrome. Unfortunately, the EU and the UK have blocked them from doing that because all the advertisers got together and petitioned the EU and the UK saying, you're going to put us out of business by blocking our cookies. And the government decided, yeah, you're right. And
said no.
Said, Google can't do that. So now Google is abandoning their plans to block cookies.
Because and some cookies are useful, of course.
Yeah.
So the original point of cookies was to personalize the actual browsing experience.
Mm-hmm.
So you could say, you know, for example, you can go to a website and some of them will say, what color scheme do you like?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it remembers that in a cookie.
Yeah.
Yep. Preferences.
Right. But then the advertisers ruined it for everybody by latching onto that and saying, oh, well, we can use cookies to feed you ads for things you've already searched for.
Yep.
And the frustration is that people don't want to be tracked. People don't want ads.
Right.
But businesses do. And so right now the business is winning, which really surprises me in the EU because they're most of the time they're more consumer focused than they are business focused.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And usually what would happen, although usually what happens is if one country blocks something, that becomes sort of the standard for the rest of the world because most developers don't want to have separate versions for every country. But Apple has started doing that. With the App Store, there are rules that the EU, a law that the EU passed that there has to be a third-party App Store available on the iPhone. And Apple did that, but only in Europe. Because
right.
So far, the U.S. government is more company-friendly. And if the company says they don't want to do it, then fine. So Apple says they don't want a third-party store because of the potential for fraud and malware, which Google found out the hard way when Fortnite came out. And
right.
Fortnite gave instructions on how to bypass Google's application security so you could download it from the third-party store. And instantly there were dozens of malicious fake Fortnite installers flying around the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so the people don't want it, but the government says they have to have cookies, and so Google is stopping this plan to block cookies.
Yep. But like I said, you can still use Brave or DuckDuckGo. DuckDuckGo, I believe, is not available as a separate program for Linux, but Brave is. Brave is available on everything.
So if their market share gets high enough, they might rise the ire of the regulators in Europe. Because Chrome has such a high market share, that's why. When Google does something in Chrome, that becomes the new standard all browsers generally adopt.
Yeah. Well, the problem is almost every browser except Firefox and Safari, I think, are based on Chromium.
Yeah.
Which is the base part of Chrome.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Brave and DuckDuckGo are as well, but they cut out all the advertising stuff.
Yeah, like I say,
most of them don't.
I just put it on the wife's computer, and it's like, yeah, if you want to go doing searching, she loves searching various websites, do it on this web page. Then you don't get all the ads. And I had to show her, and she goes, oh, I like that better.
Now, are you using the web-based version of DuckDuckGo, or have you installed the DuckDuckGo browser?
I installed it. Yeah, I installed it on both of our machines.
Because there is a plugin to use DuckDuckGo search in the other browsers.
Yep, right.
So you don't use Google search, you use DuckDuckGo search.
Right.
But no, I still like, you know, when I'm in Chrome, I use the Google search for a lot of different stuff in that. But that's totally different than, you know, if I'm shopping for something. I don't want to see all those other darn ads.
Right. Especially when I've already bought it. So Amazon, stop showing me ads for something I bought. You know I bought it because I bought it from you.
Yeah.
Yep. We found something you might like. I liked it enough to buy it.
Yeah.
I don't like it enough to buy it twice. Thank you.
Yeah. Talk about AI especially intelligence. Why does it learn? Doesn't it learn from that?
Right. Right.
Especially if the price went down because I don't want to know.
Exactly.
Oh, that would peeve me off even more.
Yep. No.
So I also subscribe to Camel. Which watches Amazon prices to tell you when something is at a low price. And so I got an email yesterday that one of my airplane radios I use is $20 off, cheapest it's ever seen, Ben. And so I went to Amazon, and it's not anymore. So it was $20 off for 5 minutes if you happen to see it at that time.
Right. And then there's the whole problem of, I forget what they call it, but it's different pricing for different people at different times of the day.
Yep. Well, a lot of times I used to call that the Mac tax, that if you went into a browser, if you went to a website with Safari, you saw higher prices than you did with Chrome.
Right. Because people will spend more money for a Mac
than
they will for a Windows machine, so you must have more money, so you must be willing to spend more money.
Yep. Or you look at the price of an item now and then go back an hour later and it's higher.
Yep.
Because there was interest in that item, so we can raise the price. Yep. It was me. I'm not interested now.
Right. So, yeah, there's just a lot going on in the background that we don't see.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what we need to do is be more aware as consumers.
Yeah. Well, and the problem is that's how the web and the internet is paid for.
Right.
You don't have to pay a fee to get on websites most of the time because they have advertising. You know, that was the television model, and before that, the radio model.
Right.
It almost might be worth, well, companies are doing that now. Because so many third-party cookies are being blocked, it's more and more common now for you to go to a website it wants you to make an account on their website because now it's a first-party cookie and it's not blocked.
Right.
And so they're generating more first-party relationships with people so they can track you more that way.
And before we get to the phone, we should talk about Duck.com.
Yeah.
Since we're talking about all of that, you can get an email address at Duck.com, and it forwards to a real email address you have, so you don't even have to learn a new system. But it strips out all cookies, all trackers, all advertising. And then when you reply, it replies through Duck.com. So all the trackers, all the ads, all of that stuff completely disappear. So I have a Duck.com address, and that's the one I sign up for with everything I don't care about.
Mm-hmm.
That I have to sign up for with something to get a thing. I use my Duck.com address, and I never see ads for that stuff. I never get tracked for that stuff. So if you want to take a look at it, it's at Duck.com, and you can very easily get a Duck.com address. And again, it's not a real address. It forwards to your real email, but hides it.
Yeah. Apple has a service called Hide My Email for Apple users.
Same idea,
yep. So use them both. So create a fake Duck account to forward to the fake Apple account to forward to your real account.
Cool.
Layers. Look an ogre.
Talk about evasion. Yeah.
All right, to the phones. Our first caller is Dave from Canandaigua, New York. What's up, Dave?
You know, last week I called and I was whining about this, that, and the other thing. And I have partial success on both of those things. First was the Bitwarden in Firefox for one website. When you use Bitwarden to fill the boxes, it would not log in. And it turns out, and somebody else had called in after me, said if you paste, copy and paste instead of using the button, that it would then accept the password. And it turns out you can also just use the regular function and then backspace on the password, like one or two backspaces, and then punch them in again, and you're on your way.
Very nice.
That's only in Firefox. You know, it works fine. Everything works fine in Google, and it works on almost all websites except for that. There's like one or two where that happens. So that was a partial. It wasn't a complete fix, but
it's a partial fix, and that's something.
Yeah. The bigger partial fix was my frustration with Zoom, and the whole thing about having the sounds drop out, the high pitched sounds like bells. Right. Well, of course you got the settings page where you got all these different radio buttons, you can click this, that, or the other thing for. But the trick is that on the main page, up in the upper right corner, next to where you got the view and the little green shield, it says original sound for musicians on or off. Well, that's not just a text box. That's actually a button, and that toggles that function on or off.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and if you spend hours reading every last vowel and consonant and letter and number in some of their help pages, you'll see where they sort of offhandedly refer to this as being the toggle to turn that function on and off.
It says recommended for studio environments, disables noise suppression, and removes the high-pass filtering. So high-pitched sounds are filtered out with that feature turned on.
Right.
Nice.
Right. And the trick is, I've been trying to find a way to, there's no way to make that the default setting. It always defaults to the way I don't want.
Of course.
And the trick is that if they made it the other way around, it wouldn't make that much difference because there's other settings on the audio settings page. And so I want to get the guy that thought this up in a dark alley. But anyway, that's what I figured out, so I'm feeling semi-alpha about the whole thing.
Well, you should be. Very nicely done, Dave. Nicely done.
Good one.
That's all I got for now.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Yep.
Thanks for putting us up to date. Thanks.
Yep.
And there's also four levels of background noise suppression in the Zoom settings. We were completely on the wrong track. We thought he was trying to do a digital audio feed into...
Right, yeah.
Rather than, no, a physical bell. Oh, that's weirder.
Yeah. Weirder. Well, it's church service, so they have bells.
Yeah,
I get that now.
That's weird, though, in the fact that he, saw that icon there, but it wasn't, like your typical one where it's like a slider or a little switch that you'd see on or off.
On my Mac screen, it's a radio button that you turn on and off.
Yeah, it'd indicate that. Otherwise, like you said, you got to go through all kinds of documentation, reading every darn little letter and vowel, like you said, to discover, wait a minute, that is a button, but it's well hidden.
There's another button there called Personalized Audio Isolation that says software on your device will capture and analyze a voice print from your meeting audio to enhance your voice and remove background noise.
Somebody's your name.
Oh.
That's kind of neat.
Nice.
Have to look through some of these options next time I'm on a Zoom call.
Yeah, give them a try. Very nice.
Too many options. Nice. That's sometimes the problem. There's too many options.
Well,
not
exactly.
Everyone can find them all.
Exactly. And often the defaults are not, as Dave said, not the defaults you want.
Yeah.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Andy from Greece, New York. What's up, Andy?
Hi, guys. My wife's phone, brand new S24,
the last week or so, all of a sudden, turn it on. She turns it off at night, puts it on the charger, lets it overnight, unplugs in the morning, turns back on. I turn it back on, and it's giving me a message that says, not updating date and time automatically. Do you want to do it manually? And there's a button to go do it manually. Time on the clock is right. Date is right. But it thinks it's not doing it. And all of a sudden, she notices that she's not getting into some of her apps as quickly as she used to. She wants to go see the news on Channel 13 app. She hits it. It takes forever to connect. I'm thinking the tour, there's something in the phone that's trying to do something, so it's using up resources and slowing down the other. But I can't find the automatic, what to do to make that automatic date and time cycle work properly. There's no switch for it. There's no button that says go do it automatically.
Yeah, there is. It, under settings, if you go to general management,
okay,
date and time, there's a switch that says automatic date and time.
Okay.
Did you find the one that says if that doesn't work, use the wipe cache partition?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't find that one. No.
So why would wiping the cat? Well, so it forgot that it's supposed to do auto date and time.
Apparently,
that's all I can think.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's not doing it fast enough. So when the phone comes up, it tells me it's not doing it, and then it picks up on it later.
Right. It would be interesting to see if she left the phone on overnight, if that message does not appear. It shouldn't, because you've already set it. But it would be interesting to see.
Yes, it's probably part of the power on sequence. I better power on and make sure my date and time is right.
Right, but if you've turned that off,
yep,
then it'll come up and say, hold on, you may not have the right date and time.
Okay, so I go into general settings, or settings in general management, and find the date and time and make sure it's on automatic.
Right.
Okay, we'll give it a try.
Give it a try, let us know.
Thank you.
You got 2 whole hours to do it.
Hour and a half.
Hour and a half.
I'll talk to you tomorrow night.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Andy. That's a reminder, by the way, that every Sunday night at 9 p.m., if you go to soundbites.org/lounge, at 9 p.m., we will have a link to our lounge chat. It's a video chat, but you are not required to turn on your camera or, indeed, even your microphone. If you just want to be a lurker, you're more than welcome to do that. But we meet every Sunday night from 9 to 10 p.m. And if you go there now, you will not see the link. You will only see the link if you refresh your screen at 9 p.m. We are welcome to join us. We love to have many people. It's essentially the same chat I have every Wednesday night with the Ask Nick people, but you have to be a member of Ask Nick to be part of that one. So it's a little more focused, generally speaking, although not always. But you're welcome to join us Sunday night. It's free, as is this show, every Sunday night from 9 to 10 p.m., almost every Sunday night. Last week, I had relatives. Every one of my wife's relatives from all over the world apparently showed up. It was a horde of them.
Crawled out of the woodwork?
Crawled. Did whatever they did it a lot.
Do you think you won the lottery or something?
Yeah, exactly. Don't know how many relatives you have, win a lottery.
Yeah.
All right, we're gonna take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. We will see you in just a couple of minutes.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. You know, normally I'm up at 1 o'clock in the morning and listening.
Oh.
Last night I was in bed by midnight, slept till straight through to 7:30.
And that's unusual slacker. For you.
For me, that's ludicrous. What?
Yeah,
that's,
slacker.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you always were up late.
4.5 hours of sleep a night, normally. Yeah. Last night, for some reason, I just went out like a light. I was just,
you know what they call that, Nick?
What?
Age.
No, I don't think they call it old age because I didn't do it the night before and I won't do it tonight. But I did it last night.
If I don't get my 12 hours, I'm a mess the next day.
But the thing of it is, though...
Which explains a lot.
Yeah.
But old age, though, slowly creeps up.
So, as long as it's slow.
You're not running any marathon, dude. I hate to tell you.
I intend to have my midlife crisis at 85. Do the math.
Yep.
All right. One hopes. Widely used enterprise software is secure enough. Get ready for those hopes to be dashed again. As Zenity CTO Michael Berguri has revealed his Microsoft Copilot exploits at Black Hat. Black Hat is a yearly event where people come and show all the exploits that they found and hopefully have been then fixed by or will be fixed by the various companies. It's actually very difficult to create a Copilot Studio bot that is safe, Baguri said, because of all the defaults are insecure. Baguri spoke twice about security failings in Microsoft Copilot at Black Hat in Las Vegas this week. His first talk focused on the aforementioned Copilot Studio, Microsoft's no-code tool for building custom enterprise Copilot bots. Copilot lets you build chat bots, essentially, that you can train on your information. So when you call up a company and you spend 45 friggin' minutes talking to a robot and never talking to a human being, that's what Copilot does. The second covered all the nasty things an attacker can do with Copilot itself if they manage to break into the system of an organization that uses the tech, as well as how to use Copilot to gain that initial access. Zenity, for what it's worth, offers, among other things, security controls for Copilot and similar enterprise-level assistance. Bear that in mind. If you don't have much exposure to Copilot Studio, it's a tool for non-technical people to create simple conversation bots using Microsoft's Copilot AI that can answer people's questions using internal business documents and data. This is made possible by what's called Retrieval Augmented Generation, or RAG, and it's worth a rag, too. Companies can create customer and or employee-facing bots that provide a natural language interface to internal information. Unfortunately, for all the Copilot Studio customers out there, the default settings in the platform are apparently entirely insufficient. Combine those with nearly 3,000 Copilot Studio bots in the average large enterprise, we're talking Fortune 500 level companies here, along with research indicating that 63% of those are discoverable online, and you have a potential recipe for data exfiltration. That is to say, someone stealing your corporate data. Specifically, if these bots are accessible to the public, and a good number of them are, they can be potentially tricked into handing over, or simply hand over by design, private information during conversations. Unfortunately, new default settings that keep Copilot bots off the public internet by default currently only apply to new installations, so users of the suite who installed it before now should check their deployments. Does your company use Copilot? Give us access, or just call us at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415.
And the Copilot AI is now rolling out to all Windows 11 machines.
Right, right. And it is inherently insecure.
Yep.
So congratulations. Well, that's not a big deal, honestly, because Windows has never been inherently secure. So adding one more insecurity is not that big a deal.
I always claim it. But then what's the feature that takes the snapshot of your screen? Recall. That's the new thing they're starting to roll out.
Right.
It takes a picture of your screen every few seconds, so you can go back in time and see all your stuff.
Right. Well, it's not just your screen. It's your entire workspace.
Yeah. And so any passwords you type are captured? Any private communications you've gone to are captured? And
if you're reading a company email on the screen that's supposed to be private, it's captured.
And it's ludicrously easy to get into that database.
Because it's not protected
in
any
way. Because it's not protected,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. But Microsoft says it's encrypted. True. But when you're logged in and using it, it's decrypted.
Right, and that's the same thing for BitLocker.
Yeah.
You know, they say, well, BitLocker will protect you because it's encrypted. It's only encrypted when you're not using it. The minute you log into your machine, you have decrypted it. So if you get a virus while you're using your machine, which is the only way to get one, it's going to be able to read all your data because you decrypted it. People don't understand that. The only thing BitLocker does is protect your hard drive if it gets stolen. If somebody steals your laptop, they won't, and they don't have your password, and your password is strong enough that it's not easily broken, then they can't get into your data.
That is the
only time BitLocker protects your system.
And on the other side, same thing with FileVault on the Macintosh. The danger is that encrypting your drive makes it more vulnerable and more susceptible to bit rot,
right?
And write errors.
If your system crashes and you have to bring it into Steve's shop, yep, and it had Bitwarden on it, you're highly likely that you are unable to retrieve those data.
You're right. So the data is stored as a blob of noise.
Right.
And the password decrypts it. Well, if something is wrong with that blob of noise, it stays a blob of noise.
It will always be a blob of noise. Yeah. There are lots of other better ways to do that. Now, this is different from encrypting data before you send it to a cloud storage area. So, for example, if you have an Excel spreadsheet that belongs to your company and you password protect it, you have encrypted it based on that password. As long as you keep that password. Is that noise?
HVAC.
Ah, very exciting. As long as you keep that password safe.
What? Real good for a radio station.
Exactly. As long as you keep that password safe, you will always be able to decrypt that thing. And if it does corrupt, you have lost one spreadsheet.
Yeah.
And hopefully you have backups, which can also be, by the way, encrypted backups, as long as you still have that password.
But don't encrypt both your main computer and your backup drives, because that's just begging failure.
Right. Good. Encryption is good in certain instances. For traveling data,
yep,
encryption is excellent. So if you are sending someone files over the internet, encrypting them is a great idea. If you are saving things to the cloud, encrypting is a good idea. But when a program is at rest, there are much better ways to protect them than encryption. Again, something like BitLocker will only protect your system if the hard drive is stolen, whether it's inside or outside the computer. That is the only time it is protected. Otherwise, every time you open it, it is susceptible to every possible virus you might get. So be aware that those things are not panaceas. They are not all fixing things. They are only as good as you let them be.
And they're all links in an overall security posture.
Right.
Yeah, that's the right buzzword, right? Your security posture.
Your security posture. That's right. Otherwise, you'll be put out to security pasture.
Yeah.
So be aware that, you know, if you're talking about your personal data, you probably want to protect, you know, tax data, that mm-hmm. sort of stuff. Absolutely. But you don't need to encrypt the whole hard drive. Nobody cares about the letter you wrote to Aunt Edith last week.
But you losing all the pictures of the new baby is horrible.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
So you want backups, and you want them to be unencrypted. Look, we've talked about this many times. If you are an Amazon Prime customer, you have the right to store an unlimited number of photos up in the Amazon cloud.
But be reasonable, because they might change that.
They might change that, right. But right now, you have that right. Why are you not taking advantage of it? Seriously, if you're already paying for Prime because you like the movies or you want the free shipping or whatever the reason is, you also have free access 100% free access to all the photos you want to store. Do it. But again, those are not encrypted photos. So depending on what kind of photos you take, that could be a problem. But no judgment. We're a judge-free zone here. But if, you know, if your pictures are the normal kind that most people think about taking, storing them up in the Amazon cloud is a terrific way to do that. But they don't have to be encrypted. Nobody cares what that picture of Aunt Enid looks like except Aunt Enid. She's probably the only, maybe Uncle Mort.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it. Everybody else doesn't care. So you don't need to encrypt those things. But your, you know, your household budget or your
personal information,
yeah. your banking information, that sort of stuff, absolutely should be encrypted. Now, if you keep it in a program like MoneyDance, it can be encrypted. If you save it as a spreadsheet, you can put a password on that spreadsheet. Now, be aware that when you put a password on a spreadsheet or a document or whatever, the encryption is only as good as the password. So if your password is A, don't bother. If your password is quite long and complex, numbers, letters, symbols,
something NPass might generate.
Right. Then yes, absolutely be encrypted because it's going to be pretty secure. But again, for almost all of these programs, your encryption pattern is based on the password itself. That makes it actually more secure if your password is good, because it is unlikely that they will be able to break the encryption without knowing the password. But if your password is lousy, then your encryption is lousy, and it will be broken quickly.
Well, a good example of that is like my old Facebook account. You know, I had that back from when we first started the show. So I literally had thousands of people in there for my contacts.
Sure.
The one problem I had, folks, and hopefully you folks don't run into this too, is at the time when I set this up, I had my website and everything else through Jerry Seward's server, my email and everything else. So, what was it? It's been, I think, 3 or 4 years now. It got hacked.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to send me a replacement password so I could verify. One problem. The email address that I used no longer exists because it's no longer up on Jerry Seward's
site
hosting it. So there was no way I could bring it back. So I literally lost thousands of contacts and other information on my old account. Now, hence, I've turned around and, as you folks well know, I use NPass. And I have created passwords, I guarantee you, on all my email accounts and into getting into Facebook that no hacker in God's green earth is going to be able to crack, at least not in my lifetime.
And that's a lot of things people forget. You change your email address, you change your phone number, you have to go back into all of your accounts and update your information. So when you forget your Google password and they text the phone you haven't had in 20 years, you cannot get back in.
Yeah.
And something like a password manager like NPass will help you with that if you use it properly. So, for example, in my system, every time I have a recovery email address, I put that in the notes section. So if I lose contact with that email address, I go into NPass and say, find me all of this email address.
Yep.
Oh, I have to change this one. Oh, I have to change that one. Same with the phone number. Put it in the notes field. It is searchable. And so you can go back and say, okay, this doesn't exist anymore. I have to make that change while I still can.
And the thing of it, too, though, and you know, I've told other folks, I don't care what site you're going to. You know, maybe you're, I'm only going to go here once. It doesn't matter. It only takes a few minutes. Go into EnPass and create a better password for it.
That's also a good way to make one of those hide my emails. Because if you're never going to use it again, you don't want to fill your main email with junk.
Because even if you're just going to that one site, say just one or two times, they still are getting personal information. And they can hack into you. So by all means, use EnPass. Let it generate a ludicrous long password. You don't have to worry about that. You've only got to worry about the one main password getting into EnPass. The rest is, they'll handle it, and it's all secure because it's encrypted.
Right. And you have, honestly, you have no excuse anymore.
No.
There's no reason not to use a password manager. Again, we Dave and I both use EnPass. I don't know what you use. You use the Mac.
Keychain. And the Mac, yeah.
Same concept. We use EnPass. He uses Keychain. It doesn't matter what you use as long as it's a good one and it's regularly, you keep it updated. And one of the beauties is of having a password manager is I have a friend who keeps all his, I know you're listening, keeps all his passwords in a notebook. Problem is, he doesn't always cross out the old ones.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll go through a book and you know, I always tell him, start at the back.
Yep.
But he'll go through the book and say, try this one. If it's in EnPass and you change it, in EnPass, and it's the one place that it gets changed and it doesn't save the old one. You can save the old one into the notes field if you want to. I don't know why you'd want to, unless you're a pack rat like me, but that's the only reason.
Do you ever run into a problem where it sometimes doesn't save the new password when you change it?
No.
Because Keychain does that for me now and then.
No, it never. I have never had that problem on EnPass.
Nope.
Never. I have had it. If had it not save, if I don't hit save.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There is a save button.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you do have to hit that. It can only do so much.
You want to update this password.
And hello.
So whatever flag tells the password manager this is a password, apparently Safari didn't catch when it tried to update.
Oh, no. This
Keychain.
As long as I remember to hit the save button. Yeah. And if I don't, EnPass comes up with it still in my face next time I bring it up. It's right there in my face saying, you know, here it is. Save button is right there.
Yep.
Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'll save it now.
Keychain has an option for recently generated passwords. So if it doesn't save immediately, because you'll never remember it again, there's a recently generated, so it can find the one that you
generated.
That's
nice.
Yep.
And the other thing is that something like EnPass, and there are others that do this, will tell me what passwords have been reused.
Mm-hmm.
What passwords are not secure, and that's important.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've got passwords that I created 25 years ago. Not as secure as the ones I create today.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it tells me you've got these
weak ones. You'll sit there and say, oh, this one's weak or could be compromised and everything else.
Or if it has been compromised, most of the password managers are looking at the Have I Been Pwned database. Yeah.
And you know, for example, I've still got one in there that I just keep for sentimental reasons. It's ICQ. ICQ doesn't even exist anymore. But I have, you know, I've got a four-digit number five-digit number for my ICQ ID, and I keep that one in there even though the password is junk. But that was back in the days when eight-character passwords were huge. It's important, I think, to remember that you've got to pay attention to this stuff. It takes a minute, but you got to deal with it. All right, to the phones. Our next caller is Fred from Rochester, New York. What's up, Fred?
Hey, me again.
Yep.
Just maybe a word of caution on using a password manager that makes crazy long passwords. I've had a particular site where I wanted to change the password, and it did not take, but my old password still worked.
Yeah.
If I deleted it from EnPass, I'd be out of luck.
Yep.
For lack of not being able to say what I really.
Yep. That's yes, I understand.
It's proper. Yeah.
That has to do with bad programming.
At the other end. They have some weird limitation on what they accept as a password.
Yes.
Often the length.
And it accepted it. And it didn't. But my old password still worked. And luckily, because I'm also a pack rat, I saved it in the notes field. And my new password didn't work, but I could copy and paste the old one that was a bunch of characters long.
Yep. Yep. And what's happened is the password manager only takes so many characters. The person who wrote the password login cuts it off after that many characters.
Right.
The person who wrote the change password didn't. So the password they saved is shorter than the password you put in, so the passwords don't match.
Yeah.
All right.
There was even a letter someone had written into Security Now where the password was truncated to 10 characters. I put in 50. Oh. The other end truncated it to 10 without telling me.
Right. And then the only way you can find that is to start at something reasonable like 8 or 10.
Yeah.
And just add one until you actually hit the number and what they think it is. But that can take weeks.
And you get locked out for too many incorrect attempts.
Right.
What I like is the sites that give you the password requirements before you type it in.
Before.
You type in a password and it says it doesn't meet the requirements. Well, okay, what are the damn requirements?
Mm-hmm. And right, and why didn't you tell me that ahead of time?
Yeah.
Yep. I've had ones that they just didn't take.
Yep.
And it was because of some... I didn't tell me before or after.
Yep.
I put the password in, and thinking that I've now entered a secure password and it's saved until the next time I go to log in, and it's like doesn't work.
Yep. No, I get it. The companies that write the code, the people that write the code, are just some of them are amazing and some of them are crap.
Amazingly idiot.
Yeah. Right.
Yes. So just you know. Just that, you know, the things that I've done that turned out wrong, I try to share. Maybe somebody else won't have that aggravation.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you, Fred.
Because if you don't save it and you try to log in and it doesn't work and you have to go through the whole process of forgot my password or, you know, all of that, and that's a whole other headache in some websites. Some sites make it. It's secure, but it's not that hard to go through the process.
Right, exactly.
Others that go through the process and it doesn't work or doesn't take until tomorrow or whatever the stupid thing is. I generally, if it's a store, I generally go shopping someplace else.
That's exactly right. If it's Facebook, you just have to send me your firstborn male child.
Yep.
All right, thanks, Fred.
Bye.
All right, that music tells us that the first hour of this show is in the books. The history books, that is, not the cookbooks. But we'll be back with a whole nother hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's a whole nother hour of Dave Enright, a whole nother hour of Steve Ray, a whole nother hour of me, Nick Francesco, and a whole nother hour of your calls. But only if you give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 800-790-0415. Take a quick bio break, grab yourself a beverage, adult or not, and we will be back in just a few minutes with a whole lot more sound bites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you in just a few.
Computer talk you can understand. More sound bites is next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester. A public service of the Greece Central School District. Jazz 90.1.
Celebrating 50 years on the air in Rochester.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, we're hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Dun-dun-dun.
Ta-da.
Ta-da.
Oh, this... Lord, this is... If a malicious website pings a 0.0.0.0 IP address... The whole internet runs on IP addresses, internet protocol, and their octal quads, right? So it's 255.255.255.255. Every address in the internet follows that protocol. I know there's IPv6 calling some other show. Anyway, that's how that works. But 0.0.0.0 is a very specialized address. It's supposed to be protected, but web browsers on Linux or Mac OS won't question it. They'll route the request to the application listening on that specific port. Security company Oligo Security, Oligo Security, has discovered that these open doors for attackers haven't been closed for 18 years. Malicious websites can bypass browser security measures and interact with services running on an organization's local network just by trying to access a 0.0.0.0 IP address. Potential users include unauthorized access and remote code execution. A long-standing flaw affects all major web browsers on Linux and Mac OS, including Safari, Firefox, Chrome, and other Chromium browsers. This issue does not affect Windows systems.
Oh, that's very surprising.
Very surprising. Dubbed 0.0.0.0 day, this vulnerability is a fundamental flaw in how browsers handle network requests from external websites. Browsers do a good job handling cross-site requests, such as when one website wants to load data from another website, such as Google Analytics or embedded videos from YouTube or, you know, something from Facebook that you grab. Security mechanisms restrict requests to servers on private networks. This keeps malicious websites from using cross-site request forgery attacks to access private data, internal networks, and local applications. For example, I run a Plex server where I keep a bunch of movies and stuff locally that I can watch on my local network. You cannot access it from the outside. It is not routable to the outside world, so it is protected. For example, attacker.com cannot access 127.0.0.1 or 192.168.1.1 IP addresses that are considered private.
Attacker.com is for sale.
What is it? Good for it. But apparently the 0.0.0.0 IP address is special. This strange IP is named this host on this network, or simply localhost, and has, and I quote, multiple uses. Apple, Mozilla, and Google are all working to fix this flaw and block access to 0.0.0.0. Chrome will start blocking access starting with Chromium version 128 and gradually roll out, and the gradual rollout of the change will be completed by Chromium 133. Apple Safari will block access in its upcoming version, iOS 18. Mozilla has no immediate fix for Firefox, but it is also in progress. Mozilla has changed the fetch specification, or RFC, to block 0.0.0.0 as a temporary fix. Finally, a good reason to run Windows. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415.
Isn't localhost 127.0.0.1?
And 0.0.0.0.
Ah.
It's both. That's a special case. What amuses me is that this has been around for 18 years, and apparently nobody noticed it.
Or somebody's noticed it, and now that the good guys have reported it.
Well, right, yeah. Right.
That's usually how a lot of these malicious exploits are found, and why they're called a zero day, because the good guys didn't see it first. The bad guys saw it, so there's 0 days of warning. And so you have security research firms always looking out for weird things. They'll have honeypots trying to draw bad guys in to track them down. And who knows what the bad guys already found before the good guys find it and fix it.
Right. All right, to the phones. Our next caller is Gary from Fairport, New York. What's up, Gary?
Hi, guys. I'm watching you here on YouTube. You are beautiful.
Thank you.
I have what I think is an interesting story about Spectrum Cloud DVR.
Okay.
Where I had a problem, and to make a very long story short, quickly, I submitted an FCC complaint, and there was a tech issue on the Spectrum side, and they fixed it. So,
wow.
It's pretty. Is this something you want to talk about on your show? Yeah,
sure.
Would it affect other people?
So what happened was my wife and I re-record the ABC Nightly News with David Muir every night, so that way we can skip through the commercials. You know.
So 90% of people who record on DVR do it for that reason.
No, I thought it was time shifting.
Yeah, that's the reason.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There is a word. And this one day I started getting an error that said can't play it back because of an FCC, FCC duplication rule. And a big blue, it was like a blue screen of death came up on my Cloud DVR playback on through the Roku Spectrum app. And so I called Spectrum and they said, well, they didn't know what I was talking about, right? And I was on the weekend and they said, well, there's an FCC complaint number you can call. And I said, well, all right. So I'm dealing with Spectrum and now I got to deal with the federal government. So I actually called the FCC on Monday.
Nice.
And they talked to me. They talked to me. Right?
What, actual humans?
Whoa.
They believed me. They sort of believed that I was having a problem. And they said, here's what you got to do. You got to fill out an FCC complaint on the FCC.gov website. And you go through, it's complicated. You kind of go through a bunch of scrolls. And you actually end up saying, the provider is Spectrum, and here's what's going on. And like the next day, Spectrum Tech called me back.
Wow.
And they have to, you know.
Right.
Get the FCC involved. They call back quick.
Yeah.
So what was really cool was it was so cool to talk to Spectrum people where their first question was not, are you sure it's plugged in?
Yeah.
You know, right? And, yeah.
Cool. Or you got it turned on?
And and right from the start they said, well, these were the people that said, yeah, we know that there's been some changes in the Cloud DVR, like, engineering, right? The software.
Nice.
You know, and they didn't know exactly what my problem was, but they called me 4 or 5 times, and we went back and we did experiments and recording different networks and which worked and, you know, different shows. And finally, they narrowed it down, and they finally called me back one day, and they said, we think we got it. Does it work? And it didn't, of course.
Right.
And then the next day, they called me back, and they said, what do you think? And it worked. Like, they actually, Spectrum went in and made a software. This took about a week. It was July 4th week it started.
Right.
So it took a couple weeks to get everything straightened out. But, like, they went in and made a software change because I called them.
Did they ever say exactly what it was?
Not exactly. I got the impression it was just a misconfiguration in, like, either, like, the distance I was. Because in this particular case, there was no duplication of the show that I had access to. There's only one ABC affiliate that I have access to on my Spectrum app.
Right.
To stream it. And so I think there was just some kind of configuration issue with either how far I was or where the ABC affiliate was or something like that. You know, they had 500 miles in instead of 50 miles or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had to adjust the database.
Yeah. I found an interesting article on Spectrum Community's website. It's his. Your handle is Gary Go on Spectrum, isn't it?
Yeah. That's me.
Oh, here's someone that's talking about it. Oh, that sounds like the same guy.
Yeah.
Well, Gary, well done you, I have to say.
Yeah. Congrats.
Get the FCC involved. Stuff happens.
Sorry, I figured you guys would want to know.
Yeah. Right. No, thank you for calling.
Perfect. Yep. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, bye.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, so the FCC non-duplication rules are basically you can't have two ABC affiliates in the same overlapping area or of any broadcast station.
Right. Right, that's why you have your 5,000 watt, 15,000 watt, 40,000 watt, 50,000 watt channels, so that there is only a limited amount of overlap. And certainly not on the same signal, and certainly theoretically not involved, not owned by the same company. Although clearly that isn't quite the same anymore. But
yeah.
The reality is that apparently the FCC getting involved perks up everyone's ears.
Yeah. Now we were having a problem Thursday and Friday with our YouTube TV, where on my wife's account it kept giving her some weird error, jumbled message numbers, saying that you have to subscribe to this contact. And she, I am, and she's an authorized user.
Right.
So I go on my account and it works fine, but on her account it didn't work. And what I think finally turned out to be the problem, because it's working now. I had a customer on Thursday that was having problems getting Google Mail. It was taking way too long for Gmail to process. It took an hour for an email to go from me to her, sitting next to each other, from Google to Google.
Right.
And then so I go to Down Detector, and there's thousands and thousands of reports of problems on Gmail. So Gmail had a problem. Google had a problem Thursday afternoon.
And she signed in by a Gmail account.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
So it affected more than Gmail. Well, maybe YouTube TV couldn't access Gmail to verify she was logged in.
Right.
And so she gets so frustrated so quickly that, of course, it's my fault.
Of course it is.
Yeah, and she's trying to watch this show that was on the Discovery Channel, recorded on YouTube. Okay, let's go to the Discovery app and watch it there. Okay, that worked.
Right. All right, to the phones. Our next caller is Kathy from Palmyra, New York. What's up, Kathy?
Hey, I have this really strange thing happening. I switched from one iPhone to another iPhone, and when I went back in to get into my email account, my Microsoft account, all the passwords were transferred over, but for some reason, the transfer, I can't open my Outlook account with the same password. I just wonder, everybody has this problem before. It didn't ask me ever on my old phone to re-enter the password or anything like that. So I just think it's kind of strange that I get this new phone and I can't access my email anymore.
Well, initially, that's not unusual. It's a brand new device. You have to authenticate on that device so they know it's really you doing it and it's not the bad guy trying to log into your account. I've got another customer that's running into this too. Do you happen to have the Microsoft Authenticator set up as a second factor login on your account?
I don't think so.
He didn't either until it started asking for it. So, So a lot of services will use two-factor authentication. Text messaging has been common for a long time, but text messaging isn't secure. So a lot of companies have started going to an authenticator, which is a separate app you run on your phone to give you a one-time code. And since Microsoft makes an authenticator, Microsoft is quick to require authenticators on their own services. What I would try doing is going into your phone settings, remove the email account, and add it back again, and then it should go through the authentication process to authenticate your access on that specific phone.
And it's not going to ask me, because what it's been doing is I've been trying to do it online, too, and it keeps asking me to send a code to my phone number, which is an old phone number, and I can't access that number anymore.
So that's why you can't get your mail, because it will not work until you respond to that two-factor code. Are you still logged into your account on any other device, computer, tablet?
The problem is I think I am, but the reason I got the new phone is because the old one will no longer connect to Wi-Fi.
Mm. So you need to log into your you need to already be logged into your account so you can change the two-factor phone number.
Okay.
I don't know if there's a way around that. Let me do some Googling.
I did send them the email to try to get the recovery process, but you know, it's just they ask you questions that are really hard to answer. They want to know, you know, emails you sent before, and I like, I don't, and
they're trying to protect your account from a bad guy breaking in. So it's supposed to be stuff you know, and that becomes tricky. Especially if you've had your account for decades in some cases.
Oh, my God, I have.
Yeah.
I really have. I have, like, passwords, old passwords. You know, I have everything on record. And it's like, you know.
But it's trying to send a code to a phone you don't have anymore, and there's almost no way around that.
My other question would be is why, when I go on the computer, I still can't log into it. It's still asking me for that same phone number. It just seems like on a computer you will be able to get around.
No, it's logging in on any device. And probably the fact that your login failed on your phone set your Microsoft account into a suspicious nature. So now it's going to check every login and ask for the two-factor code that you told it to use. So that's what we said earlier. If you ever change your phone number, you have to go into all of your accounts and update your phone number. I'm looking at different ways
to... Yeah, I tried to get into Microsoft to do, you know, like where it has your account settings and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it, obviously, I can't get in with that account, but I do have another Microsoft account. And I did get in with that one, but it still doesn't let you change the phone numbers without asking you to verify your email.
Yep, that's why you have to have a valid alternate email and a valid alternate phone number already in your account ahead of time.
No way to get back that, because my problem is that email account is only to my Etsy seller account, so I can't get into my Etsy seller account. I did send them a ticket, so I'm wondering if they're going to be able to give me my account back by resetting everything.
If you can prove your identity, and that's the problem. Okay. So you have to be able to answer some of the questions they're asking you.
They shouldn't ask me. They should be able to go around the recovery phone number, though, right?
Right, but you have to prove it's you and not some bad guy trying to break into your account.
Okay.
I am posting a link from the Microsoft Community Forum that gives a couple of videos and a URL to start the account recovery process.
Okay.
So that's
going to be a long and involved process, but persist and you will be fine.
Yeah, it's going to be. Got the emails out, so all I really care about is that Etsy gets back to me and that they're able to just, you know, reset everything so I can get back in by using a whole new, you know, because I don't want to close my account because I have like all my customers and everything on it.
Of course,
right? Yeah.
If I got to go back and redo my Etsy account, I'm going to be so mad. So I'm hoping that we're with me.
And make sure you put your current phone number on the new. There are cases with Microsoft and Google we've run into, Facebook, where if you cannot prove your identity to their satisfaction, you cannot get back into the account.
Yeah,
we had a customer the other day where they were trying to get into his Facebook account. They had him scan his driver's license front and back. Yeah, I've had to do that too.
I'm all into that, and that's cool because when I did do my my verification processes before on the Meta, I did do that. I have no problem doing that. It's just I have to think, I gotta make stuff a little bit easier for people. You know, I mean, even through like the video ID now, do that.
Unfortunately, if it's easier for you, it's easier for the bad guys too.
Exactly, it's what sucks.
Yep.
All right. Well, I appreciate your input on that, and, you know, everything makes sense to me, so it was actually Paul that referred me to, so I will get back with him and let him know what we figured out, but thank you so much for giving me that information. I really appreciate it.
Yep.
Thank you, Kathy, and good luck. Let us know how it works out.
I will, definitely. I'll be back with you guys and let you know.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, it's... We really, you need to put together a checklist.
Yeah.
Of all the places that you have saved that phone number, you've used that phone number as your two-factor authentication, that it's the verification. Same with your email, your phone. We talked about this earlier.
It's probably every account.
Put it all in your NPass notes field, I use this phone number. I have two phone numbers. I have the physical phone number that's associated with my phone, and I have a Google Voice number. And I keep track of which one I used where. Now, the Google Voice number is actually much more convenient because even if I lost the phone, I can use voice on my desktop through the web browser. So I can do all kinds of things that way. So I personally tend to use my Google Voice number more than I use my physical phone number.
I have found a lot of websites won't accept a VoIP number as a two-factor code, which is annoying.
Yeah, right. Where I can, I use the Google Voice number. But yes, a lot of places won't accept the VoIP number.
And so that's why more websites are now starting, have been starting to ask for an authenticator app. And even newer now is Passkeys, which I hope is going to catch on more. So basically, you try to log into a website, it shows a QR code. You scan your phone, looks at that QR code, and then asks for your biometric ID, your face ID or your touch ID. And then the phone tells the website, yep, that he authenticated biometrically, that's him, let him log in. So the big advantage there is the other end doesn't have a secret to lose, because they always do.
Right.
And that's how all your passwords get lost, and bad guys find them.
Yep. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Tom from Irondequoit, New York. What's up, Tom?
Hi, guys. This sort of ties in with what you've been talking about. I talked to you guys last week because I couldn't get on Facebook because when I asked for the two-factor authentication code to be sent to me via text, all of a sudden it never stopped coming.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you told me that I'm going to have to go through the recovery process, all right? I tried one other thing because I was having problems with the medical patient portal. I went into Firefox. I changed my privacy settings from strict to standard. And once I did that, now I get the two-factor code sent to me.
Interesting.
That doesn't make any sense.
I went from the strict privacy setting to the less, I guess, controlling standard setting, and that solved the problem.
Yeah, that's supposed to block stuff coming into you. It shouldn't block a text message going out.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it just stopped
coincidentally
the message going to Facebook. I don't know. All I know is that it worked.
That's the important part.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm glad you solved the problem.
Yeah. No. And didn't you say that to get the two-factor authentication code, instead of a text, you're better off having a phone call sent?
You're best off having an authenticator app.
Okay.
To use. And both Google makes one, Facebook makes one, Microsoft makes one, Apple makes one. Everybody makes one.
Okay. And you can use it even on the Windows system?
Yeah.
Okay.
You just pick the one you like best, or you can have multiples. It doesn't matter.
It depends on which ones the website supports sometimes, too.
Right, okay. Right.
See, I don't think Microsoft would support the Google Authenticator.
Maybe not.
It may. Well, there's a standard for authentication protocol, so they should.
So okay. It shouldn't matter which app you use.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but on Firefox, is there any problems that you can foresee for me when I change it from strict to the less protective standard setting?
Well, strict clearly is a little better, but it standard shouldn't be a problem.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, because I know when I hit it on strict, I couldn't get on this medical patient portal that I get on.
But what it might have been blocking was a cookie.
Yeah, that could be.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can also do strict and allow that one site.
Oh, okay. Oh, is there an options in that?
Yeah, there's usually an option that says allow cookies on this site.
Exceptions.
Whitelist sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I know on my iPad, I could not get on Facebook until I went into the settings and unblocked and then love.
Yep.
Yep. So. All right, we got to go. Thanks, okay. Tom.
Thank you very much, guys.
All right, we're going to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and with you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's right. It's Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. We'll see you in just a couple of minutes.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 34 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And we have Ed from Rochester on the line. What's up, Ed?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a question, if I could, about the Chromebook. I don't know if all the instructions are the same. This is a Lenovo. I use it as a hotspot at home, and it connects pretty good. But recently it just will tell you that it's connected, and then it says no internet. And I was going around for the directions on the phone to find them out, and also on the Chromebook. And it says to go into settings and pull up the network. And after you click on network, supposedly, underneath the network is an option for the hotspot. I don't see it. And my question is, do you guys know if that's hidden someplace else? Because when you click on the hotspot, if you right-click, it'll tell you what your password is, and you can put that in to make sure that it's connected to the Internet. So, but I can't find where they have a hotspot, even following the directions from the Chromebook.
It could be the cellular chip has failed, and that's why it's not connecting to the hot chip, and that's why it's not seeing it. But Nick is looking now on his.
Yeah. Yes, it should allow you to, under network, there should be hotspot. And you're saying that's not even there anymore.
Yeah, it just goes Bluetooth, connected devices, accounts, device personalization, search and assistant, and apps, and then it goes into the advanced. But that's it for options.
Is there a button anywhere on your computer to turn the Wi-Fi or the hotspot on or off? Some laptops used to have a button to turn the Wi-Fi off because it would drain the battery if you didn't need it.
Well, I usually do that from my phone. When I'm done transmitting, I just turn it off, and I just watch the screen, and it'll tell me it's not connected. Then I just, close out the Chromebook. Now, for some reason, I took it, long story short, I took it back to Best Buy. There's a woman down there that's pretty good. And she said, you're not connected. So she found it on, I thought I'd ask her, didn't write it down. She clicked on the network, she found it, and there's a list of different, passwords. And this looks like the one, when you first got this, it would give you the password for the hotspot to connect. Now, they update these things about every week, and they don't do that anymore. So you have to go hunt for it. But as I say, according to the directions, I don't even see it listed under network, and I don't know if it's even supposed to be there, or unless you click on something else, and then it'll come up. That's what's throwing me.
How old is this Chromebook?
About a year and a half. It's a Lenovo.
Is it just out of warranty?
No, what I was thinking was that it didn't do 4G.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, if it's 3G only and 3G has been shut down, then it won't connect because there is no 3G anymore.
No, I think it's 5G because my phone's 5G. And it connects great. When it, this just happened. I hit connected devices, for example. And it'll show the phone that's enabled, quick share, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, are you using your phone as a hotspot?
Ah.
Or is the hotspot in the Chromebook?
No, well, my phone is a hotspot. It's connected to the Chromebook.
Oh, yeah, then the Chromebook just sees it as a Wi-Fi network. You tell the Chromebook to look for Wi-Fi.
So you set up the phone as a hotspot, and then you connect the Chromebook to the phone.
Right, sorry, I should have told you that. I thought you knew that. I'm sorry.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, it's the other way around. So if you've set up the phone correctly, then you need to have both the cellular network and Wi-Fi turned on your phone. And then the phone turns itself into a Wi-Fi hotspot, and right. you see a list of your Wi-Fi connections mm-hmm. in the on the Chromebook.
You won't
and
see
one
anything.
One of those will be
the name of the phone hotspot.
Right.
You won't see anything called hotspot on the Chromebook itself. It just sees it as a Wi-Fi network.
Right.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, what it comes up as, I see the Wi-Fi is on. This will come up. It says known networks. It's got my phone in there, the Galaxy
yeah.
A14.
That's the one.
But
and you connect to that, and now you're connected.
But sometimes, see, that's why I'm calling you. Sometimes I'll do exactly the same thing, and it'll say, connect. Even the color's different. It'll say connected, period, no internet.
That's a problem at the phone end, then. If it's connected to the phone, but it cannot connect through the phone to the internet, that's a problem with either the phone itself or the cell service.
You might be in a dead zone.
Right,
yeah,
or it
yeah,
may
yeah.
just be that there's an issue. One thing you can always do is go to downdetector.com.
Okay.
And check your cell carrier and see if they are having a problem with connectivity.
Yeah, it's at Verizon. No. Okay. Downdetector.com?
Downdetector.com. And
okay,
if it's not showing up on the front page, search for Verizon.
Okay, good. All right, I'll give it a shot. Okay. Hey, thanks, guys. Appreciate
yep.
it.
Good luck. Yeah, a lot of people tend to use their, particularly if you have unlimited data, you can use your phone as a hotspot. And then what happens is it turns it essentially into a regular Wi-Fi router. And you connect to it the same way you connect to your home router. It shows up in the list of Wi-Fi connections, and you just connect to it that way. You have to, you know, when you set up your phone, you give it a password and a name. It comes with a name, but you can change the name, and I suggest you do.
Yeah, so on the phone, it's called Hotspot.
Right. But I would suggest that you set a good password, just as you would on your home network, and then you find it on the Chromebook or on any device, your tablet, whatever. You find it on that device as a regular Wi-Fi network, and you connect to it just as you would to any other Wi-Fi network.
Did you have a story where you were traveling somewhere with your family and someone demanded your hotspot password?
Yeah, well, two stories. One is we were taking the train to somewhere, New York, I think, and I had set up my phone as a hotspot so that my wife could do her Facebook
farm. Yeah, she was doing the farm game.
And somebody came by and said, is there internet on this train? And my wife said, no, my husband set up his phone as a hotspot. And she went, oh, that is so sweet. Sweet? I want to sleep with both eyes closed.
Yeah.
The second time, you're right, I was sitting there and some woman came over and said, how are you getting internet? I said, I've set up my phone as a hotspot. She said, give me the password. No.
Hello?
No, who the actual do you think you are?
$10 a minute.
Yeah, exactly right. For $50, I will, sure.
Yeah, give me $50 and
$50.
I'll let you have a half hour.
You're right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Jim from Brighton, New York. What's up, Jim?
Hi, I have a question concerning making sure you ought to get automatic updates. And I think this works if you always buy the application, like Malwarebytes or Super Anti-Spyware, and you get the purchase version, automatic updates occur. Is that correct?
Depends on the product, but on many of them, that is one of the perks of purchasing,
yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
Usually the free version will tell you there's an update, but you have to click the update button.
Yeah, and you got to go searching for it. And,
right.
And
whereas
it.
With many apps, not all of them, but with many apps, if you buy the app, if you pay for the app, the update comes to you automatically.
Matter of fact, like you heard us, if you were listening before, you heard us talking about NPass. On NPass, if you pay for it, matter of fact, when an update comes out, it'll put a little warning up in the upper right-hand corner saying, oh, there's an update. You might want to do this one. You just go ahead. I don't even have to think about it. And it just Oh, all right. Yeah, do it.
And in some of them, it's even more automatic than that. So, yeah.
But there's no consistency. No. Sometimes it's the free version. Sometimes it's the paid version. Sometimes you have to do it manually yourself.
Very often,
paid versions
automatic
are
updates
more.
Are one of the perks of purchasing, but not always.
Yeah. You remember, there used to be a program called, what was it, Oil Change?
Yeah.
That would automatically check for all your driver updates instead of needing to go to 10 different companies separately. So Microsoft, and on the Windows side, Microsoft handles a lot of those updates for Microsoft and your hardware drivers themselves. On the Apple side, you get things from the Apple App Store. That handles updates themselves. But things you install yourself from that original company website, you generally end up doing yourself.
Right.
But you are correct. I'd say a good 80% of the software that you purchase or support, that's one of their big features, is that you will constantly get updates because you are paying, to keep them going, and that's what they want you to do. So, it's a win-win both ways.
Now, also, there are apps that you bought a version. So all the version 4, for example, updates, 4.1, 4.2, whatever that is, are free. But if they go to version 5, you pay again.
Yep. A major.
Yes. And that's different for every application, too. Sometimes you bought 4 yesterday and 5 came out today. They might give you 5.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, Jim, in general, you are correct. In many instances, paying for the app gives you automatic updates.
Very good. Thanks, fellas.
Yep.
And paying for the app.
It's a really simple question he asked us, yes or no. Yeah. We gave him 20 minutes of maybe, maybe not, who knows.
Yeah, but no, for the most part, though, we've been saying that for decades.
Yeah, always
by
the app.
Support these people because that's what gives them the incentive to keep the program going
and doing the
updates. And changing features or adding this or adding that, because I've known a couple of the software packages that I use. I put in one, and I know of two other operators that put in requests. And because we're paying members, a couple of months later, all of a sudden the option's there. It's like, cool. It's well worth the supporting.
Yes. While many, many programmers who write apps for the public that are shareware or freeware, whatever you want to call them, will do updates regularly. Human nature, they're going to pay a little more attention to the people who paid for the app than the people who didn't pay for the app. And I think that's absolutely their prerogative.
Oh, yeah. They're the ones that are spending countless hours of writing the code and then testing it and, doing all that stuff and maintaining in it. People don't realize that, especially for freeware and shareware. It's usually new programmers that just have a need and they thought, okay, well, I'll go ahead and do this. And if it catches on, fine. It's like throwing spaghetti up to the wall and see if it sticks. And, a lot of folks, they'll find, oh, yeah, I like this program, and then just sponge off of it and never support, but yet they'll sit there and complain, well, it doesn't do this, it doesn't do that. Whereas, if they actually help support it, it drives that person to do other and newer things with it.
Yep.
And that's been true, for decades.
From Buttonware, from Jim Knopf, who created Buttonware. I forget what the products were. I paid for one of those, and he wrote me back and said, holy cow, somebody paid for this.
Yeah.
I may be the first person. Whoever gave him money, I don't know. But
I've called tech support, and I go, hey, this is Scott. Scott, the same Scott that wrote the program? Yeah, what can I do for you?
Yep. I told you.
Because it usually is one guy.
We're perfect. I wrote to them one time. I said, I just bought this brand new printer. It's not on your list. Can you give me some idea of when it's going to come out? They wrote back immediately and said, give us the model number. The next day, they wrote back and said, we went out and bought one. Try this driver.
Cool.
And it did like 90%. I said, it doesn't do this. Try this driver came the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Worked perfectly.
Winner, chicken dinner.
No question. I was a huge fan for many decades of WordPerfect. Great product, great people. Very, you know. Now, I grant you, the customer base was not as large in those days. That's true. They may have had only a million people, not a billion. You know, but still, they took that time to say, we'll actually buy this printer and write a driver for this. This was in the days when you had to put your driver in yourself. But
yeah. Well, you remember this program because you're the one that encouraged me to get it and use it. Total Recorder.
Total Recorder, great program.
Yeah, and paid for it. The guy got all excited. Oh, thank you very much for your support and everything else. And, you know, you just constantly get updates.
Yeah, he was sending them out by the truck.
Yeah,
road.
Yeah, you know, and just for, you know, simple support. And I have always been the belief since I started in computing, if it was a program that I liked and I enjoyed, yep, I'll support it. If I'm not going to use it, then fine, I'll take it off and maybe find something else. Right. But if I'm going to use your product and, you know, and I like it, I find it helpful, I'm going to support you. Whether even, like you say, even if it's just throwing them $20 of that, they're elated.
That's
because,
exactly,
you know,
right,
you're helping them keep their vision, which they thought, well, I don't know if it's going to take off. But, you know, they tried it and this just helps encourage them to do more.
So there's a program that I use very rarely. And every time I use it, I get caught by this. Every time I use it, I say, I should throw them a few bucks. So I go to their website, and it seems that they have a subscription model for like $15 a month. I use it four times a year, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe three.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to pay $15 a month.
Right.
To use it, but if they had a thing where I could throw them $20, $30, $40, I would do that. But I'm not going to pay for a subscription that I will use two or three or four times a year.
Yeah, we're seeing more and more companies going to a subscription model because they say, and they're right, it gives them a guarantee knowing what their income is going to be.
Yeah,
they have a baseline they can live with.
Mm-hmm. And even one of the podcasts I listen to, Escape Pod, short form science fiction, it's really nice to have people read stories to you.
Yes.
they'll take donations, but they prefer the subscription because then they know they're going to have that money. They know they can pay their authors. They pay their slush readers, which is
nice.
Very uncommon in the literary world.
The slush pile,
yeah.
When you write a manuscript, if nobody has asked for it, you randomly, blindly send it into publishers. It gets put in what's called the slush pile. And it's the basically women and children first. If we've got time, we'll read one.
Yeah. We were at a convention once with there was a publisher there on how to publish your own stories. And they talked about their Friday night slush parties, where they take all the stacks of unsolicited manuscripts that came in, and they open them up, and there's a manuscript and a self-addressed stamped envelope to return, and they put in a cover letter saying, thank you for your submission, but we're not accepting submissions at this time, and seal it up and mail it back out again.
Yeah.
A lot of publishers won't accept unsolicited commissions,
of course,
submissions.
There used to be a book called The Writer's Bible, The Writer's something. I mean, it was a thick book. It was 2 inches thick. And it was a list of all the places that accepted submissions and how and when and in what format,
yep,
and in what genres and et cetera, et cetera. And you would buy it every year, and then you could say, oh, I'm a romance author. So I look in the romance section, and I see that this publisher is accepting 50,000-word manuscripts on historical romances, and this is the format they want it in, and yada, yada, yada. Oh, I'm a science fiction author, and this is the, you know. So you can go through the sections and see what they give and what they do. I don't know that book even exists anymore. I'd have to go back, and it's probably still on my shelf from 20 years ago, so.
And probably half of those publishers don't exist anymore.
Probably not.
Yeah. So now you go to Amazon and you make a Kindle book.
Well, exactly. And then the problem is now you have to sell it. Right. It used to be that
marketing.
Marketing is a tough part.
Writing is easy. Parentheses, but marketing is the hard part, and getting people to buy your books and booking the bookstore tours.
Well, right.
Bookstores are hard to find anymore.
Right. As Ernest Hemingway said, write drunk, edit sober. writing is easy, editing is hard. But the market has changed drastically. One of the things, talking about romance novels used to be huge. Then they became very, very small part of the market. People were embarrassed to be seen reading them. And then they got huge again because people were reading them on their Kindles.
Yeah.
So nobody knew what you were reading. So you could read what was considered trash on the subway or whatever.
Yeah.
And nobody would look at you and judge you for reading it.
And then there were so many genres. There was the dinosaur romance novel.
Dinosaur romance novel, computer romance novels. We won't name any of the titles, but they're certainly out there. You can look them up if you feel the need to. Mostly they're porn, actually. But there's...
Well, depending on how graphic the romance novel is to begin with.
Well, right. Right. The term romance novel covers a lot of territory. But there's a great deal of material out there being written by first-time authors. And the tough part is not finding it. It's finding the good stuff. Just because you can type doesn't mean you can write. And it's a very different world out there than it used to be for that stuff. That's why so many sites now are recommendation sites.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you like X, you'll like Y. Or, you know, if you like science fiction, try this. I do a lot of rereading. The Bain Library, BAEN, has a free library of science fiction books. I think I've read every one of them at least twice. They are downloadable for free. They are readable for free. Basically, they're older novels that Jim Bain himself originally said to the authors, look, you've made your money off this book. Let's offer it for free. Sometimes it's volume one. Right, which makes a lot of sense. You know, I wrote the Death Stalker series, 8 books, Simon R. Green. First one's free. You know, first taste is always free.
Rum and hook 'em.
That's exactly right. And I get that. I do. But a lot of them are one-offs, and a lot of them are people who just say, look, I've made my money off this book. Go ahead and enjoy it. And maybe if you like me as an author, you'll start buying my new stuff, too. So there's a lot of free stuff out there, and there's a lot of inexpensive stuff out there. One of the things that a lot of beginning authors don't do well is price their books. There's a problem. There's a difference between, you know, it's free, I will try this, or it's 99 cents, I will try this, or it's $4.95, maybe now it's actually worth $5, I'll buy it.
Yeah.
So it's a real issue that people are running into, but...
Sometimes I don't like starting a book series until I know they've ended it. So
right.
I made the mistake of starting the AN14 series.
Oh, yeah.
It's like 150 books in it so far, but they have sections. You read this section, then this section, then this section, and they all tie together in an overall arc, but wow.
Well, you can read all the Shadow books because Walter P. Gibson is dead. He wrote 283 of them. Out of the 320, I think it is, that there are out there.
Yeah.
So you can read the entire Shadow series, the entire original Doc Savage series. Tarzan, Edgar Rice Burroughs is dead. You can read Pellucidar and Barsoom. And
a lot of those are available at...
Internet Archive.
Internet Archive, yes.
Yeah. That's the other thing. A lot of the classics... like those you can get for free at the Internet Archive. All right, that music tells us we are done for another week. Wow. seriously, wow, that happened faster than I thought it would. I want to thank Dave Enright. I want to thank Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. I want to thank everyone who called in. We had great questions this week. And great help from other people who gave us answers that they had found somewhere else. That's my favorite part of the show, by the way, is when people call in with answers we didn't come up with. But we are done for another week. Please feel free to join us tomorrow night at 9 p.m. soundbites.org/lounge. And we will L-O-U-N-G-E. And we'll be having some fun there. And we will see you in just 166 hours. Be good to one another, will you? You deserve it, and so do they.